2 миллиона долларов и почти год слежки. Тайна операции российских спецслужб.
Органическая часть этого режима. Он вместе
Игорь Сечин отказался приходить в суд по делу Улюкаева.
Глава Роснефти Игорь
Сечин. A sting operation. An oil deal. A bag allegedly filled with cash. Or maybe just sausages and wine. A sitting minister arrested for the first time since the 1950s, a highly publicized trial, leaked wiretaps, and a powerful witness who's repeatedly refused to appear in court. And in the middle of it all is Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin, one of the most shadowy and feared figures in the Russian elite, and a decades-long crony of Vladimir Putin. The corruption trial of former economics minister Alexei Ulyukayev and Sechin's role in putting him in the dock are providing a rare window into the high-stakes power struggles in Putin's inner circle. Court politics, it appears, is back in more ways than one, and it's back with a vengeance. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vody, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome, Mark. So, even by Russia's Byzantine standards, this case is weird. For starters, Ulyukayev is accused of threatening Sechin and soliciting a $2 million bribe in exchange for his support for Rosneft's acquisition of a majority stake in Bashneft. Now, for starters, the very idea of somebody like Ulyukayev threatening somebody like Sechin is a bit absurd. And moreover, anybody who threatens Sechin shouldn't be arrested, they should be committed. Second, Ulyukayev was not exactly decisive in approving the Bashneft deal. And third, the wiretaps that have been released appear to exonerate him. And finally, Sechin allegedly collaborated with law enforcement in a sting operation against Ulyukayev, but is now repeatedly ignoring summons to appear in court. Now, my take on this case is that it's part of the intramural clan struggles within the Russian elite, clan struggles that are intensifying as the election approaches, and many are assuming that the Putin era is entering its final lap. As Sechin acquires more and more energy assets and the political clout that goes with him, others in the elite are pushing back. And it's not just technocrats like Ulyukayev or First Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov. According to a report by veteran Russian journalist Mikhail Asokin in Sobeshchednik last week, Sechin is also in conflict with powerful businessmen close to Putin like Gennady Timchenko and Boris and Arkady Rotenberg. How do you see this case and its wider implications, Mark?
Well, I think I'd want to posit a slightly different picture of Sechin for a start. You talk about sort of more assets, more sort of hydrocarbon assets, meaning more political clout. In some ways, I'd flip it round, because in many ways, it's a slightly flippant way of looking at this massive corporation. But in many ways, I tend to think of Rosneft as basically a pyramid scheme, notoriously badly managed, notoriously corrupt and inefficient. In many ways, for years now, its business model has often been to snap up additional resources and particularly more efficiently run resources, which Bashneft absolutely counted as being, using Sechin's political clout. So it's not that assets mean political clout, it's that political clout means more assets.
Uh-huh.
So I think this is what we've seen. And it's actually, therefore, a lot of this is simply about Sechin's need, I mean, much like any shark, to keep swimming. Mm-hmm. He can't afford to stop. And I think at this particular moment in time, that is what is problematic. Because, I mean, I agree with you, this is not just your classic liberal economic approach versus state-down, big complex sort
no,
of type approach.
No, that's what makes this interesting.
This is something, I think, exactly. I mean, this is a time when basically resources are more tight than usual. The competition, even amongst the very big beasts for those resources, has got greater. And Sechin, in some ways, because he has been so desperate to expand, I think has broken the etiquette mm-hmm. of intra-elite relations. And although it sounds silly to say etiquette as if it's about whether you wear white after Labor Day or pour the tea before the milk or the milk before the tea, but nonetheless, I mean, in a system which is so thoroughly deinstitutionalized, etiquette is precisely what keeps it together, that common shared understanding of how things are meant to be. And I think that's what Sechin has broken. And I think this is why Sechin is facing a backlash from unexpected quarters.
Right. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, Mikhail Asokin, veteran Russian journalist, former presenter on NTV back in the 90s, had a very interesting piece in Sobesednik last week in which he said that basically Sechin is bumping into Gennady Timchenko and the Rotenbergs. Now, if this is the case, and that is one of the things behind all of this, it suggests to me that kind of Putin is kind of caught between two branches of his innermost circle. And in such a case, it's unpredictable to say where he's going to go, if we take for a given that Asokin's story is correct.
Well, I mean, I think it does fit with the other sort of signs that we're seeing, exactly, because it didn't. Let's be perfectly honest. Sechin doesn't really have much trouble bulldozing over ordinary levels of opposition. Mm-hmm. I mean, the very fact that he actually, as it seems to be, it's not yet been tested in a court of law, but appears to have framed Ulyukayev. And in fact, at this rate, it won't be tested in a court of law for quite some time.
Yes, Sechin did not appear in court again today.
Exactly. We can come back to that in a moment. But I mean, I think in this situation, exactly, it's the unpredictability of collisions within that innermost elite. And I've often wondered this about Sechin. How, I mean, he clearly is in that inner circle, but it's not quite so easy to see the kind of easy personal relationship between him and Putin, as we know exists between, for example, the Rotenbergs and and others. And I wonder if, in fact, this is Sechin's capability of ultimately losing his friends. I mean, remember, he came out of, you know, he was once upon a time regarded as the sort of the leading light, the patron of the Siloviki.
Yes.
And certainly I've now found that basically no one whom I talk to within that realm regards Sechin as at all one of their own. Sure.
Even though he has a Siloviki background.
Exactly. But
reportedly GRU.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that's been fairly sort of comprehensively proven. So, but even so, I mean, that he's long since abandoned them. Mm. He's now become a hydrocarbons baron. So
they,
frankly,
see him as an oligarch like anybody else.
Exactly.
Now, the way this used to be framed was a GRU versus FSB thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's way, way too much emphasis, in my opinion, put on that. It makes for great conspiracy story news articles and things. But the idea that either the GRU or the FSB is either A, coherent enough to represent such a force, or B, would be allowed to. I mean, look, one thing that Putin does understand is power. And we know that, you know, he's happy to use the security agencies, but he's not willing to be in a position where basically they are independent power brokers and power baronies of their own. And the very fact, I mean, the same people who tend to think of this as an FSB versus GRU struggle also are the people who suggest that basically Sechin had taken control of part of the FSB, which, again, I think is overplayed. I mean, instead, what it represents is the fact that basically the Russian system is one in which, see, I don't believe in clans or these institutional blocks, which imply some degree of coherence and unity and common interests and discipline.
So you see shifting alliances.
I absolutely see this. Everyone is a political entrepreneur in their own right. And obviously there are kind of natural constituencies that come together out of either, you know, attitudes and opinions, views of how Russia should change, direct, you know, where does the money come from, and just personal relationships. But these I think are much more amorphous, and they tend to be cross-cutting. They tend to cross, you know, go across institutional boundaries. But the thing is about Sechin is Sechin never seems to have made allies. I was actually spending a bit of time looking at this, trying to work out, well, who would be a Sechin ally? And obviously there are sometimes alliances of convenience. But basically Sechin does not look for allies. He looks for subordinates. And to an extent, fine. If you're a really powerful figure, you can accumulate subordinates such as the FSB General Feoktistov,
right,
who was so central in the Ulyukayev case. But again, at the top table level, he's not going to get a client amongst the innermost Putin circles. And I think the thing is, he just doesn't seem to have allies. And I think that's okay up to a point. But when you also combine that with acting in a way, in a Nyakulturny way, I'm almost reminded of Lenin's testament and his famous sort of indictment of Stalin.
Right. You
know, Stalin's Nicholson thing, he doesn't know how to behave appropriately. Well, I think Sechin has reached that point.
Well, one thing that is puzzling about this to me as well is why Ulyukayev? I mean, he really wasn't a decisive figure in this privatization, let's face it. Okay, he's a minister, but his voice was not the decisive voice here. Why go after Ulyukayev? Because this was clearly, if we're following the assumptions I've been reading in the Russian media about this, Sechin basically set up Ulyukayev. This was a sting to set him up. It's funny when you listen to the recordings of the so-called incriminating conversation. I don't know if I was missing something in the Russian. I don't think I was. I didn't hear anything incriminating there.
No, I think sort of Sechin clearly couldn't even handle a proper sting. And again, I think it says something about a certain arrogance, which we're also seeing with the sort of non-appearance at court and so forth, that he almost feels, well, once he's put the wheels in motion, then surely the machine should handle the rest. No, I mean, I think why Ulyukayev, this is supposition. I mean, you know, we've got to have, more than under normal circumstances, we've got to have all these little asterisks, footnotes and health warnings. But I think one is that Ulyukayev clearly did inject himself into the whole Bashneft issue. Mm-hmm. And I think, quite frankly, got up Sechin's nose. Again, this is a man who I think has no problem visiting malicious personal vendettas on other people. We've seen that before. Secondly, it's Ulyukayev was kind of powerful enough that I imagine Sechin regarded him as a useful example of why you don't mess with him.
Mm-hmm.
But not so powerful that it would seem as too problematic. I mean, going for someone like Shuvalov, you know, who is kind of
a lot of people think is the real
exactly.
target here.
I think going for Shuvalov, I think even Sechin, I think would have regarded that as being a stretch and a dangerous stretch. So this is a way in which you show your muscle, you weaken the other person, you show that you're not to be trifled with, but in a way that he thought would be actually rather more straightforward than it's turning out to be.
But now we appear to be getting pushback. I mean, we're getting pushback in the sense that these embarrassing transcripts that don't implicate Ulyukayev appear to make Sechin look incompetent are mysteriously being, you know, leaked to the Russian media, appearing online. I mean, that site almost crashed when that audio recording went online last week. Somebody's pushing back.
I think lots of people are pushing back, and this is a thing. I think it's one of these cases where obviously those who live by the leak die by it as well. But I think if one was going to make a suitably seasonal drama, I think it would be sort of Murder on the Orient Express, in which, spoiler alert, it turns out that everyone committed the crime.
Okay.
I think this is the interesting thing, because you actually have this quite bizarre alliance. On the one hand, you clearly do have the economic liberals who have long regarded not just Sechin as a problem, but Rosneft as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really has to be dealt with if anything can be done about the Russian economy, because that is so crucial. Secondly, you actually have people within the inner circle for whom Sechin is just getting a bit too big for his boots and a bit too problematic at a time when there's a lot of instability generally about
the Rottenbergs
the future.
And Timchenko.
Exactly. But then you also have, for example, within the security apparatus. I mean, it's interesting that basically those people whom Sechin appears to have suborned within the FSB have been purged, or at least put into much more, less important positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bortnikov, and therefore by extension his lord and master and patron Patrushev, you know, are clearly making a case that in fact, no, Sechin does not control the FSB or even part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is the fascinating thing. We have all these different forces converging, and Sechin himself proving to be actually quite incompetent at how to handle it. I think particularly this refusal, this consistent refusal to turn up to court, which doesn't, I mean, apart from the fact that the excuses begin to look silly, and he begins to look ridiculous.
Yeah.
But also, look, one thing we've got to understand about Putin is that, bizarrely, given that this is such a lawless kleptocratic state, Putin does seem to set quite a bit of stake in the actual
appearance of
legality. You know, this is why nowadays the favoured way of raiding businesses is not just to turn up with some leather-jacketed thugs, but to come and have a court document that claims some non-existent debt or whatever. Well, likewise, I think by so flagrantly flouting the court and by seeming to hide behind both Putin and, bless him, Medvedev, to do that. I mean, if you have to hide behind Medvedev, you know you're in a problem. I think Sechin is making things worse for himself.
So it sounds to me, you know, I thought Sechin might be about to take a fall about a year ago, but it turned out that it was Ivanov and not Sechin. But at the time, I thought Sechin had lost a series of fights regarding the Rosneft privatization. And apparently, at the time regarding the Bashneft acquisition, fights he eventually seemed now won. Is he pushing his luck? Could this be the next Yakunin, the next Ivanov?
I can certainly hope so. but I think particularly, I mean, I think, look, whether or not Sechin will go, I don't know, just simply because at the same time, Putin might well be very averse in this quite sort of volatile moment in the run-up to the elections to basically not get rid of Sechin. I don't think that's the problem. I think just imagine the pit fights for who gets to control Rosneft
right.
and its assets. And it may well be that he's not quite comfortable enough to uncork that amount of mayhem. But certainly, I mean, I do think that we're getting to a point where Sechin is being shown that he's not as powerful as he is. And this is also a classic Putin thing. He actually doesn't want, usually, to dispense with his closest friends and allies.
But he did it with Ivanov, and he did it with
Yakunin. Well, Ivanov, I think, was jumped rather. I mean, I think Ivanov wanted to go. I honestly don't think that was a sacking.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, people I've spoken to say, really, ever since his son died in that car accident a few years back, Ivanov hasn't been the same, hasn't had the same passion and enthusiasm. And I think it reached a point where he just wanted to move. But yeah, you know, Yakunin, obviously Putin will do it. But I think that he tends to give people, you know, or institutions, the chance, to, you know, a few chances to redeem themselves. Now, I don't know if I might say Sechin's already used. I don't know how many lives Sechin
has.
But you know, it could be that just simply he'll end up humbling. I mean, again, if we think back to, for example, the big Silovik War.
I wanted to bring that up. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, essentially. He started Putin started by basically putting the FSB in a tough spot and more or less sort of encouraging other agencies to take a bite, but then eventually came out and as it were, saved the situation, saved the FSB. But it was clearly because he wanted the FSB to be humbled a little, to realise that it was dependent upon him. Well, likewise, I mean, this could just be Putin wanting to put Sechin back into his relevant sort of place on the org chart. But I think actually the point at which actually Sechin really starts to alienate people who are closer to the body than him, I think is a point where actually he really is in dangerous territory.
Now, remember the context the Siloviki War unfolded. It was 2007, 2008. This was the time when Putin's second term was nearing an end. There was uncertainty about what was coming next. There were those that wanted him to stay for a third term. This isn't happening exactly at that point in the timeline. This time around, it's coming at the end of his third term after the little brief break with Medvedev. But it's coming at a time when people are beginning to think about life after Putin. And that was also the case in 2007, 2008, which unleashed all sorts of demons in the inner elite. So I would place this in that context. Would you do so as well?
Yeah, but interestingly turbocharged in the sense of, I think the life after Putin issue is all the more stark at the moment just because Putin is older and the circumstances are different, but also because of the economic situation. Now, okay, in 2008, the ruble was going to take a tumble when part of the global economic turnaround, but, you know,
but
no one knew that.
Broke out in 2007.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, actually, that was a time of relative plenty.
Mm-hmm.
Now we actually have a period of relative scarcity, which actually, given that most of these struggles at some point or other are really about control of resources, I think that actually is making it all the sharper. But at the same time, the last kind of but, I don't know, on the third hand, shall I say, this is also a time when exactly it's important not to look disloyal.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one of the reasons why I think Sechin is blundering, because he's allowing a lot of this stuff to come out in the open, when in fact the ship of state does not want to be showing any leaks at the moment, and therefore I think for this reason you've got almost all the more pressure, but at the same time all the more incentive to try and keep as much as possible of it behind the walls of the Kremlin and the dachas on the outskirts of Moscow.
Do you know if you're looking at, you know, Putin's going to have to do something here sooner or later. He's going to, Ulyukayev's going to be found guilty or not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is fascinating. This is a case that we have an unpredictable outcome, as I noted on the Daily Vertical last week, not for the reasons you would hoped for in a truly independent court, but because basically you have a fight between Putin's closest cronies. What does, I mean, I'm trying to work this out for myself. It'd be interesting to hear what you think. What the decision Putin ultimately makes, what does that tell us? What does the Ulyukayev acquittal tell us? What does the Ulyukayev conviction tell us? What does Sechin being put in a box tell us? What does Sechin being allowed to roam free tell us?
Well, in some ways, precisely. I mean, I think if we think of this, this is basically a two-by-two grid. Because conceivably, Ulyukayev could be freed, and yet nothing happened to Sechin.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, I think that's the sort of the most gentle of rebukes. It's, no, you went a little bit too far here. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, boys will be boys. And you know, as long as you realize that for the future, things will be fine. Conversely, if I mean, you know, obviously the most serious thing would be Ulyukayev goes free and Sechin gets either thrown out of his job or in some other way clearly sort of taken down a peg or two. And let's be honest, at that kind of level, even just a sort of an apparently stray comment on TV by Putin, even if just Putin says, I don't think Sechin handled himself well here.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is a major signal of shifts within. So anyway, we could see that. And then, of course, there's the options of Ulyukayev going to prison, and yet, or being rather being convicted. I mean, whether he goes to prison is another matter. And yet also Sechin being taken down a notch, which is more or less a kind of, I think, would be a basically, look, all of you, time out for everyone, kids. You know, which is actually would be Putin trying to just generally sort of tamp down the situation, or indeed Sechin winning completely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think really the key thing, therefore, is whether or not Putin sees the greatest risk as being from what Sechin is doing, in which case he has to slap Sechin down,
mm-hmm.
or from generally the elite and the sense of that the elite are competing amongst themselves, which is just another symptom of thinking about life after Putin.
Right.
And I'm slight, I mean, look, with all the extra sort of caveats, again, Putin is not Stalin, but I am slightly reminded of the situation that you know, was obtaining in post-war Stalinism and the period when he was clearly beginning to kind of crank up, ready for another wave of purges. Before, fortunately, mortality did the job. It was in part because he realised that what was actually happening was that an elite, which had changed during the war, was now almost regarding him as not insignificant, but not pivotal. There were all kinds of alliances and disagreements and so forth that were actually being sought about the elite, and he felt less central to the system, and he wanted to remind people that he was central to the system. Well, I wonder if Putin is actually feeling a similar-ish kind of feeling himself, that almost actually sort of as if he needs to just remind people, hello, I'm still here.
That's one possibility, and closely related to that is that Putin is truly losing his grip on the elite.
I see no signs that he doesn't have the power to reach in and basically slap anyone down or basically destroy anyone. If he chooses to. I mean, obviously, everything has a political cost. And it's a question of how far he can be bothered, how far he's willing to marshal the cost. But I mean, I haven't seen anything that all I can say, this is the trouble with sort of negative evidence. All I can say is I haven't seen anything that makes me think that he cannot do this. That, you know, if he turned to Bastrykin and said, it's time for Sechin to be locked up. You've got 24 hours to find a suitable case. I can't think Bastrykin would say no.
I don't think it would take him 24 hours.
Well, exactly. Maybe it was the evening. But, you know, I don't believe for a minute that Bastrykin wouldn't and couldn't. You know, I think he has enough people on whom he can turn that I don't think he has to worry. I mean, we don't really know. But as I said, in the absence of any evidence of the contrary, that's what I'm assuming.
Right. Well, that's a very good segue to shift into our second segment where we're going to broaden it out a bit. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion, broaden the aperture, and get even wonkier, looking at the clans, fractures, alliances in Russia's ruling elite as it prepares for what appears to be Putin's last campaign. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Российская элита.
Элиту нужно обновлять. Обновлять нужно кровь. Это совершенно
внутри элит обострилась конкуренция.
Включены люди из ближнего окружения президента России Владимира Путина.
Так называемое политбюро.
In the latest edition of his Politburo 2.0 report, which came out last month, political consultant Yevgeny Minchenko wrote that two broad coalitions were forming in the Russian elite. Mobilizers and modernizers. And within those two broad coalitions, of course, there are numerous factions, rivalries, and shifting alliances. The report identified a lot of familiar names as being part of the inner sanctum of Kremlin power. Dmitry Medvedev, Sergei Shoigu, Sergei Sobyanin, Sergei Chemezov, Yuri Kovalchuk, Igor Sechin, Vyacheslav Volodin, Arkady Rotenberg, Viktor Zolotov, and Gennady Timchenko. Moreover, speaking to the Independent this week, former Kremlin insider Gleb Pavlovsky said the upcoming presidential election is about, quote, transitioning to a post-Putin Russia. Likewise, Valery Solovey, a professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, said the election is less about the future and more about the end. This all seems to be heading towards intensified clan warfare in the coming year. Mark, how do you see the elite breaking down right now? Who are the key players and the key factions and alliances, in your opinion?
Well, look, I think I'm obviously in querulous mood today. I'm going to start by slightly sort of questioning Minchenko's terms. When he talks about the sort of mobilizers versus the modernizers, well, this is just a repackaging of the usual perspective. Somehow you have these kind of economic liberals versus economic illiberals, which, okay, is to an extent true, but I think it actually is much more complex. And I think we can look at these various names that have been mentioned, and they're all sort of powerful figures. It's questionable, though, how presidential in the current terms of the system any of them are. I mean, ironically, if one looks at those names, it's really Shoigu and Medvedev are the only two sort of plausible presidential candidates. And I think people are aware of that.
Sobyanin, I would add to that.
I wonder if maybe, but not quite yet. I mean, I think to jump from Moscow mayor to president.
Well, we're not talking about somebody becoming a president next year.
Well, no,
year.
Exactly. I think that...
And we're not even sure what kind of a system we're talking about. We could be talking about one in which Putin has some supreme leader role and the president is basically an errand boy. Right?
Absolutely. Well, yes. I won't quite say, no, you can't put anyone behind the big desk and that. I mean, even Medvedev, to an extent, grew in the position. Then he was popped. But I think what is more is actually, I think we have to realize that we're in this fascinating time in which actually in an often subterranean way, politics is returning to Russia.
Court politics is.
Well, I would say actually all forms of politics are. We're also seeing it sort of within the grassroots level, but obviously we're focusing on the Kremlinology side of things now. And absolutely court politics is. But here you have differences between self-interest, people who are purely, it seems, driven by just what is going to protect their interest and make them money, and people who actually do have some sense of, for want of a better word, an ideology, or at least a vision for what they want to create. People who just simply want to kind of maintain the status quo, between people who are actually appreciating that the status quo really is not a sustainable thing. Obviously, a whole variety of very kind of specific personal issues and so forth, but also a more general, and again, it's interesting, we're back to an old concept, which is, you know, the managers versus the owners.
The shareholders and the managers.
I mean, but because actually what was interesting from Minchenko's list is that there are quite a few people who I think have considerable power within the system, like Patrushev, like Vino. But nonetheless, it's executive, it's institutional, it's bureaucratic power. And it's true that any of those could be sacked. But then again, any businessman can be discovered to be a tax dodger or similar. No one has genuine control over their own assets and resources in this kind of system. So, I mean, I think I would want to kind of, if I had to sort of broaden, broaden the political spectrum. I think, again, it's that we are seeing, in some ways, the emergence, slow emergence, of a, I wouldn't say a reform coalition, but a change coalition. And in that respect, it's a little bit like the coalition that Yuri Andropov pulled together when he was becoming general secretary. It's basically everyone who thinks something needs to be done. And in some cases, that is genuinely motivated by a relatively liberal, modernizing, liberalizing belief. In others...
Well, this wasn't the case with Andropov.
Well, no, it was. I mean, Andropov's coalition included everyone from the sort of Yakovlevs and Gorbachevs on one side to real hardline so-and-sos like Aliyev, you know, who actually thought that change meant tougher discipline and more efficiency and so forth. And I think this is what we're seeing at the moment. There isn't yet a vision for what kind of Russia there ought to be. So I think, in a way, for me, the key division is between just trying to hold on to the status quo and doing something about the status quo. But there's not yet really a sense of quite what that is.
Now, is this under Putin or post-Putin?
I think...
A little of both?
Well, I mean, I think really this is post-Putin. The question is, and here I'm just involving a certain sleight of hand, you might say whether or not you can have post-Putin politics while Putin is still there.
Alive or as the president? I mean, because there are those that argue... Even if Putin were to leave the presidency, people would still continue to believe he's really pulling the strings. I mean,
yeah,
his aura is such
exactly
that. I mean,
but on the other hand,
Oleg Kashin wrote this recently in Republic. It was a pretty good piece.
But you might say, even if people believe that, if there's nothing they can do to operationalize that, you know, if orders come down and they are ostensibly from the new president or whatever, and if actually people think they come from the father of the nation, that doesn't really matter. So long as the father of the nation is not seeking to actively intervene and interfere in politics, that doesn't matter. I mean, I think it's possible. Again, it's really, and this is, I mean, we would all love, you know, 10 minutes, Putin and a polygraph. you know, to actually, except unfortunately polygraphs don't work, but you know, then it's, but that's it. I mean, because one thing we really don't know is, does Putin want to govern? I mean, actually, if Putin is given the choice of either as president or in some other role, but allowing other people who he thinks can genuinely sort of push forwards what is best for not just for Russia, but obviously him and his friends, would he be willing to basically sit back? That's the key imponderable we don't know. And I don't think the Russians know either.
So you would agree with, I mean, Gleb Pavlovsky, as I cited earlier, told The Independent this is an election about transitioning to a post-Putin Russia. Valery Soloveyev, the professor at Moscow State Institute of International Relations, said the election is less about the future and more about the end. Do these comments ring true to you?
Yeah, I think it's there is that sense that everyone knows the end is coming, and they don't know if it's going to be in a year or 6 years or what in between. And so I think this is very much, I mean, it's not about the elections. I mean, the elections are irrelevant. But this particular political season, which
right,
is really hotted up in an interesting
this
way.
This ritual called an election, which is going to set the stage for the next political
season.
Well,
and season. Particularly, I think, Putin's continuing reluctance to actually openly say that he's going to be standing. I mean, now the sort of the latest word is it's going to happen on the 15th of December, the day after his big press conference.
Either then or at the People's Front Congress the following week, or at the United Russia Congress later that same week.
Either way, but the very fact that everyone is talking, I mean, everyone within the political class is absolutely talking about this issue. The fact that Putin has already left it later than usual to actually say anything. You know, again, all of this has opened up the issue. And so I think, yes, this is very much about positioning for the future. Not in the sense of, at this stage, who's going to be the next president. Because, as I said, none of these candidates necessarily look like it, and no one really knows if that's going to be available. But, as it were, what is going to be the next phase of politics? And then, because let's be basic, this is often how it works, it's also then a matter of selling that to the boss. There is a sense that Putin does not have a clear vision. He has a clear sense of, sort of that he wants a great Russia and a Russia to be respected in the world and all that kind of thing. But in a way, I think it'll then be up to if a more reformist coalition actually kind of coheres in a meaningful way, for them to work out what their game plan, what their vision is, and to see if they can sell it to the boss.
Now, you spoke of this reform coalition. Whom do you see? Who do you see as a member of that reform coalition?
Well, interesting. I mean, if we take just that initial list of people who've been identified, I mean, you know, some are actually sort of quite straightforward. I mean, Medvedev, you know, for all I gleefully mock him, you know, I mean, he clearly does have a belief in a law-based state.
Sobyanin.
Sobyanin, Shoigu, I think, as well. Again, not Shoigu is not a kind of happy-clappy liberal, but in terms of kind of efficiency and moving away from the current sort of dog-eat-dog sort of model. And, I mean, actually, you know, of the others, with the exception of Zolotov, who I don't think ought to be on that list in the first place, I think actually,
he's on the fringes of it.
Yeah,
actually.
I lumped together
the outer Politburo and the inner Politburo.
Sure. But no, I mean, I think the interesting thing is then you have Volodin, mm-hmm. who is again just a political manager who will look for the most efficient way, and the rest are all basically owners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is actually how it's actually breaking up. Interestingly, you know, owners clearly are desperate at the moment to hold on to the status quo. The second rank of economic oligarchs, I think, are actually much more oriented towards change, but they're not, you know, in that inner circle. So instead, what we're actually seeing is de facto an emergence once again of this sort of age-old technocrats versus kleptocrats.
But doesn't this also fall into Minchenko's kind of mobilizers and modernizers?
Well, I said my problem is that, look, I think everyone wants to modernize. I mean, I don't think that, you know, Kovalchuk is saying let's go back to troikas and so forth. I mean, it's a question of what kind of modernizers. And likewise, you know, the idea of mobilizers carries with it that sense of creating a sort of a state in which, you know, everything is subordinated to the state. I don't think they necessarily want that, because that would actually also put their own assets. I would instead frame it as technocrats versus kleptocrats. And although, I mean, obviously a lot of the technocrats are also kleptocrats. But just less successful. And although that's in some ways an artificial barrier, but nonetheless kind of tends to kind of break down in a similar sort of battle lines as Minchenko would, I think the key thing is the motivation, is actually what's behind that sense.
Now, we talked a bit in the first half of whether Putin is still the decider or whether he's losing his grip. You seem to think that for now he remains the decider.
He is, I would say, the decider in theory, but too little in practice. I mean, again, I think...
Because this
past,
is what I see. I see things happening that he did not necessarily approve of, whether it be the Ulyukayev case or the Serebrennikov case. So you see these different things happening that Putin... wasn't interested in stopping them, but didn't necessarily want them to be initiated, or was unable to stop them. These things are indications to me that things are spinning out of his control a little bit.
I agree, but as I said, I mean, I think ultimately when it comes down to it, and this is something I've been saying in the past, I think, you know, Putin frankly is tired, is feeling detached. Putin can't be bothered.
And there seems to be a growing consensus in Moscow among political analysts that this is the case.
Yeah.
That this is going to be the last turn, that Putin's tired, he wants to go. I've never seen this before. The last time around in 2007, 2008, there was speculation, will he stay or will he go? But it wasn't, does he want to stay? Of course he wanted to stay, but he had to find a mechanism to do so. Now it's, he's tired, he wants to step back. All of the talk of the post-presidential roles are things like being something like a Russian Ayatollah, to use Minchenko's phrase, but are head of the state council. But these are things that are not, where he, as you put it, wouldn't be governing. He would be presiding over those who govern. So it seems very real right now. But once you start doing that, don't you undermine your ability to be the decider?
Well... Again, I mean, for example, we'll wait and see what he does with Sechin. I mean, he can, as it were, reaffirm that capacity periodically by doing something quite striking and grand. But again, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that this becomes something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the more people think that the old guy is no longer really paying attention, they try and see what they can get away with, as Sechin seems to have, and others. Or they try and see how they can sort of squeeze into the margin. So I think this is the difference. I mean, obviously, when it comes down to it, all politics is, I've called it this consensual hallucination, this idea that you have the authority that people believe you have. I think that Putin still has enough capacity to, as it were, buck, at least in the immediate term, that capacity. I mean, I really don't think that Putin could not change any of these situations. But again, I think Putin has both combination of a disinclination to do so, but also often I think he has no particular ideas of what he wants. I mean, it's all very well. Once Sechin starts, for example, this whole Ulyukayev business, he's now in a position where he's going to have to make a choice. And actually, Putin doesn't like doing that. Putin likes to kind of ensure that he doesn't have that responsibility thrust upon him. So he is, in many ways, you know, going about whether he's a lame duck or not. I mean, he is laming himself.
Mm-hmm. And there's a need to show that he's not lame, which makes me think he might try to do something demonstrative here.
He might. I mean, again, all we can say is that either he precisely does that, and we know that he still cares, or if he doesn't, I think it's actually a very interesting and useful indicator of the extent to which he is basically, I hesitate to use the word abdicating, but a kind of almost a soft, slow abdication.
Well, this case is an interesting barometer for that reason. You and I have both, we're both dying to see the film The Death of Stalin, which I wish would show up in the cinemas here in Prague.
Absolutely.
But we've also both use this metaphor of the death of Stalin for what we may expect post-Putin because, and again, necessary caveats, Putin is not Stalin, but the system has never been so centralized as it is now since Stalin. And that what we saw at the death of Stalin was seen by both of us as a metaphor for what we may see. Who do you see as strong in the current elite in a post-Putin environment? Who do you see as strong there? Because who would have expected Khrushchev, you know, in 54? But that's what we got, at least temporarily. Now, my interpretation of what happened there, and I believe you share it, is that the elite basically agreed on two things. One, no more Stalin, which meant Beria had to get a bullet in the head. And two, whoever the new leader is going to be the front man for a collective. They thought Khrushchev was that man. When Khrushchev started behaving like his own man, they got rid of him. And then Brezhnev became that man. Do you see that exact kind of scenario playing out this time around? Or do you see something else playing out? Do you see out-and-out clan warfare, which could have happened at the death of Stalin as well?
I think there will be a particular desire to avoid out-and-out clan warfare, particularly given the current rather sort of delicate situation in which the elite find themselves. I think they are well aware that the Russian population as a whole is not particularly happy with them. Mm. The international situation is absolutely not particularly conducive to Russia. There is an awareness that Russia's quote-unquote near abroad countries are in many cases not great fans of Moscow and would appreciate the opportunity provided by any kind of internecine conflicts in Moscow. So I think for all those reasons, there will be quite a strong desire to try and avoid that. Now, it might not be enough, but nonetheless, I think there will be. So, yes, I mean, I think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see the elite trying to find for themselves someone who can, as it were, be a Putin to the country, but a collective leader to the elite. Mm-hmm. In other words, they want someone who can maintain, you know, I don't think there's going to be a general drive for a mass democratization, liberalization, or whatever, only in economic terms, because that's back in their interest. And it really to roll things back to early Putinism. But they absolutely will I think, be not wanting just simply to elevate one person. And this is why I think that if one had to look at the people who are now on the scene, I think actually it's people like Medvedev and Sobyanin who actually
and
represent
Shoigu.
The best.
That's my troika.
Shoigu, I mean, he's, you know, his big problem, he's so popular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the trouble with Shoigu is actually he would almost by definition be a strong president. Now, because he's managed to make his ascension uniquely without enemies, exactly, which no one else has done that. I mean, that is sort of quite a feat. So it could well be, but they would definitely, I think, in that case, be aware that in that case, they would just simply be entrusting their futures to him, because he would almost certainly fill that space with a lot of authority. So it may well be that someone like Medvedev, whom they don't really fear, or someone like Sobyanin, who, again, is obviously different from Medvedev and is actually quite a competent chief executive. But nonetheless, I don't think no one has ever really put the words Sobyanin and charisma closely together.
No.
So I don't think there's quite that same fear. And also Sobyanin has no existing connections with the power wielders. The thing about Shoigu is he's both popular amongst the population and also popular amongst the military, and frankly also has a considerable degree of esteem within the security apparatus as a whole. So as I said, this, for all these reasons, they might feel he's just too good a candidate.
Right. Now, what happens with all of these others, the businessmen, the Kovalchuks, the Rotenbergs, the Timchenkos, the Sergei Chemezov, for that matter, Sechin? I mean, these people who have a lot of assets now, but you don't become an oligarch in Russia. You're appointed one.
Mm-hmm.
Do they fade away? Is there a Beria in this in this mix somewhere that's going to be the sacrifice? You know.
Well, I mean, I must say, sort of, definitely, Sechin's doing his best to audition for that role.
Right.
No, I mean, I don't think so. Again, I think there would be that desire, because once you start putting people up against a wall,
metaphorically, I don't think the Stalin metaphors don't mean shooting people.
You actually force people into resistance. Again, I think what we're going to see is much more. In some ways, again, it's a little bit like the way that Putin dealt with the 1990s oligarchy, more or less saying, look, you're rich, enjoy it, fine, but these are the new rules of the game, and you may well find yourself beginning to be eclipsed by other people. But it's a question of whether you want to stand against the steamroller or whether you actually want to step to one side. So, I mean, I think that in many of them, they will sort of survive in terms of their wealth. But the interesting thing is that essentially they all depend upon robbing from the state. Whether it's in terms of massively embezzled padded contracts, and yes, Rotenbergs, I'm looking at you, some would say, or whether it's in terms of just not being at all good and efficient at their jobs and therefore presiding over distinctly inefficient structures.
I think you're looking at Sechin there.
Well, I could not possibly comment, or some would say Chemezov would also fit into that category. No, but the point is, I mean, again, it's a question of how much inefficiency can Russia afford? And obviously, all states have certain levels of inefficiency, but I mean, I think this is really what's emerged in Russia has been actually a regime that came into power preaching a certain degree of its time to actually sort of get things sorted out and so forth, has basically just created obviously a less anarchic but equally inefficient kleptocracy as Yeltsin. Now, again, I mean, I think therefore that cannot be sustained at the same level and will not be. But again, I mean, I think all we're just talking about is people who are obscenely rich merely becoming profanely rich. I don't think we're going to be seeing any kind of purges.
Right.
I think just simply, again, yet another renegotiation of the social contract. And yeah, and some people are going to rise and some people are going to do well and others probably are going to take their money and run.
And of course, the wild card, which is the subject for another podcast as we're bumping up against the end of it here, is what happens on the street. Is there going to be calls for retribution when this is all said and done, and the Navalny factor? But that's a subject for another day. On that note, we'll wrap it up for this week. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Thanks, Mark, for an enlightening discussion.
A pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.